Okay, thanks. And I'm hearing relatively consistent things. So I think everything's reconcilable. And the most, I was just saying, the one thing that I took from the agenda consultation is that most people said, as long as the board's clear on why it's given priority to things, that's the most important thing. Explain why it's what one put one project ahead of another. Some of the comments I heard are a good segue into this little last part, which I'm not going to ask any questions on at the end because it will then morph into the effects analysis. But it's about evidence-supported standard setting, and this is more about just sharing with you a few of the initiatives and explaining how we are doing some of the things. You know, Francois's point about lower the constraints, and that will actually give you a bit more flexibility to do more potentially. So what we're doing is we're moving to more evidence-supported decision-making. The idea, we're already doing that in lots of our projects. I think the leases and revenue projects, if you look at the effects analysis we've produced in those, we're justifying and explaining why the board made particular decisions on things. So it gives more objectivity. And so instead of the board saying, we think this is a better answer, we can say, this is a better answer because of this, and here is some evidence and some analysis we've got to support it, taking, again, a very wide definition of research. There can be little things like in the drafting where you set up a drafting group that you then test some ideas on. You give them a fact pattern, give them to test. Well, that gives you a bit more comfort that the wording is actually quite clear because you get consistent outcomes. And that's the sort of thing people, I think, find helpful when we do the standard setting. So evidence is helpful it's pervasive. It's right through the whole standard setting process. It's helping you identify, you know, whether field work could be systems testing. I give little examples like in an impairment, we had an expert group of people who understood the systems in banks, and we say, can you do this? And they provide some input to help us. It's better than having the standard setter sitting in an isolated room and guessing what people can do. We're actually getting some information to feed in. So we're doing a lot of this sort of thing anyway, and you'll see in the effects analysis that the biggest improvements we can make are about communicating this work. But I wanted to talk about a couple of things of the sources of the work, is that the role of national standard setters in particular, and Francoise, I think, touched on this, and we also talked about the kiss of death. If you're given a project to look after, that's the end of it. That's not going to be the case. We know that we've had experience historically with that happening in some cases. I'm determined that won't happen ever again. Whoops. We are working with national standard setters. We've already got the UK's doing a small, much more manageable piece, which is an input into our disclosure initiative on cash flows. The Italians are looking at accounting policy. I'm talking with another standard setter about doing some work on interim financial reporting, some concerns. This isn't going to take up board time, but it means that we're well placed when we're ready to actually discuss these issues. Somebody talked about doing forward planning, issues that will come up. Now, emission trading schemes is an issue that has come up and down depending on which country you're in. I don't think it's going to go away, so we need to get ready for that. And we're talking to a couple of bodies about doing some work to help us do that without taking away our staff time and our board time, at least in the very short term. So that's going to be a very big part of that. And Francoise is right, the protocol that we have together, the charter, it says we work basically as a community, helping each other on projects. And we've got lots of good examples where that's actually happening today. The other thing in terms of Begonia and the offer we had from the European Accounting Association and others, we are trying to encourage academics to do work that is more helpful to us directly. At the moment, historically, there's been a bit of a disconnect between some of the systematic research. It doesn't actually help us answer some of the questions we need some help with. So I think there's been a movement in the last 2 years or so for academics to do work that's more policy relevant for us, and we're trying to help or encourage that, particularly we announced and set up a research website called the Research Centre on our website, and that's aimed mainly at academics. It's pretty low-key for us. Essentially what we do is we give them a forward-looking program. I can tell you now, for example, when's revenue? That's 2017, 1 January 2017, so around about 2020 we should be doing a post-implementation review. So we can signal to academics that's when we are going to be starting to answer some questions or look at some issues, and so encouraging. So, and as well as that, we have some focused events. We've hooked up with high-quality accounting journals, Accounting and Business Research. It's going to be running an event, and that's papers looking solely at our conceptual framework. And that's going to be run at SAID Business School at Oxford University on the 2nd of October. We've been talking to an agreed accounting and finance in Asia Oceania journal is going to run a 2015 issue, and we've had three journals approach us for 2016 already. So we've got some engagement with the academic community to try and do some work to help us. So there are quite a few pieces going on like that. Again, we're not the University of the ISB. We're just trying to encourage people to do things that might be helpful as inputs for us rather than us doing the work ourselves. I keep telling your staff they're not having to do statistical analysis and look for things that are significant at the 5% level. We're encouraging others to do the work for us and then feed it into us in a digestible way. So that's essentially it. It's just a little bit for noting. We're going to talk now, almost without pausing, if that's all right, on effects analysis, and then we can perhaps some of those issues can be wrapped up into this. So, if I can find my notes, effects analysis, I should have this on top of my head just about. Some background. You know, the trustees in their last strategy review asked us to set up an effects analysis group, essentially to look at trying to formalise the way we do effects analysis and particularly field work. The group's met. We've had, I think, four meetings now, plus phone calls. The draft report is quite a lengthy thing. I didn't give you the draft. It's 104 pages long at the moment, and it's getting close to being finalised. What I want to do today is it's primarily informational, but I just want to share with you the main issues that came across in putting this together. And essentially what I'm going to work through very quickly are our tentative conclusions or the conclusions of the group. Now, the one thing that's become clear to me, which was both mainly pleasing, a little bit disappointing, we are doing most of the things that people are asking us to do or the group says are very important. The disappointing thing is perhaps we haven't been communicating them as clearly as we could do. So a lot of what we're suggesting in the report or the group is suggesting are about embedding and improving the way we undertake and explain the effects of financial standard setting. And essentially, it's all about good standard setting. It's simply about the ISB. It's about change management. The ISB essentially is going to change how entities report information. It's going to change the information set available to the user and investor community. And people are saying all they want the ISB to do is explain why it considered the change was necessary rather than just sticking with the status quo or doing nothing. Why change at all? If you are going to change, why that change is necessary and why you chose one solution over another. In other words, why it's an improvement and why it was worth the cost in doing so. So for many people, that's just about good standard setting. And for anybody who's been involved in standard setting for the last 10 years, it's pretty much what we expect a basis for conclusions to do. But this is about bringing a bit more formality around some of the issues in there. It's not that simple, of course. So probably the most contentious issues are at the beginning and the end. The first is, what do you focus on for an effects analysis? In other words, what do you consider? And secondly, how do you report those things? And the first one, the scope, is that the consultative group has been very supportive and quite clear that the focus of the review of the likely effects has to be consistent with the objectives of the ISB. Okay, so it's all about, my shorthand is about transparent financial information, but it's about general purpose financial reports and producing high quality information that helps people understand about the entities that are reporting and about providing resources to those entities and about their accountability. So it's essentially what our framework says and our constitution. It's about transparency of the reporting entities. So when we consider the effects, there are, I kind of think accountants are relatively simple or standard setters. Essentially all we do is we change the way we capture transactions and events. So the first order or direct effects are how you change the financial statements. When you think about it, if you go through a big process and you change the financial reporting requirements and the result is that nothing much changes in the financial statements, you have to ask yourself, why do we do it in the first place? Because you've caused some cost without getting much of a difference in the reporting. In other cases, you're going to completely change financial statements. You've almost got the opposite. You're saying, well, you've changed everything. Are you confident that that's a better representation of current practice? And that's what the board is simply justifying in an effects analysis. The other direct effects are that you cause costs because you cause a preparer potentially to change their systems. You might cause ongoing costs. It might be that if you move to a model that requires more external expertise, that it causes higher auditing costs on an ongoing basis, for example. So those are direct effects. Similarly, for an investor, hopefully what we do most of the time is actually reduce their costs, because rather than going through the costly exercise of estimating with error some information they would love to get from the companies, we're going to reduce their costs by providing the information or forcing the information directly. In other cases, though, we are going to cause them. They've got these lovely models and spreadsheets and things, and we say, well, guess what? We've just changed the numbers. So they're going to have to incur some costs in changing the way they process this. And also, you know, even learning costs, understanding what information is changing as well. So those are the direct effects of our standards. We also know that they have other consequences that people call economic consequences. We know that there are things like there'll be changes in the cost of capital. There could be shifts in the way people change their investment as a result of this. You know, I always hesitate to use it, but people say that the defined benefit schemes, there was a downscaling of those once it became obvious what the liabilities were, and they were brought on balance sheets, so it caused behavioural changes. You know, I think it's fair to say if we can change quite significantly the way a lease is classified, that would cause some changes around the efforts that people put into structuring. Won't necessarily make structuring go away, but it will change. You'll have some consequences. So we're aware of those things, and we know that there are clearly consequences of the accounting standards. And it's just being aware of those consequences that people would like us to communicate that aspect. The other thing is that, and this is probably the most fundamental issue, we don't work in isolation. Financial stability is clearly seen as being very important. The report will acknowledge that financial stability is important to a well-functioning global economy, and that as a member of the Financial Stability Board, the ISB supports the mandate of the FSB. But the important thing is that if you read down to the bottom line, we can't compromise our own objectives. We actually think that, and the group is stating that transparency is actually important for financial stability. So transparency is almost like a prerequisite for stability. And it's very important that the ISB sticks to its objective of making sure it's got transparent information. The main thing, though, is that they need to communicate, because we do know that accounting standards in particular are used by many parties. They're used by the regulators who monitor for financial stability, so those numbers feed in. And if we know that we're changing our reporting requirements and they are using those numbers today, it's critical that we communicate those changes are going to be made so they can adjust the way they think about that information themselves. Okay? Doesn't mean that we would not go ahead with a requirement because it affects the way they think about leverage, for example, but it's important they understand how we're changing how financial reports are being put together. The other is it's used in contracts. You know, when we brought IFRS into New Zealand, we had a day-long session with what they call the Inland Revenue Department, which is the taxation authority. They wanted to know how the financial statements would change, because they saw the deferred tax balance as their window into a business. And the bigger the balance, it either meant that people were being very aggressive on their tax or their accounting, and they wanted to understand. So they wanted to understand what the changes were. We spoke to the banks because we knew that the change from New Zealand GAAP to IFRS would affect bank contracts. The report's going to state that it's not the ISB's responsibility to do that globally. The ISB relies on other standard setters to do that. So what's critical is keeping everybody informed in the process. So if a national standard setter thinks it's important to speak to their local taxation authority, we did also in New Zealand, because some of the tax was linked to the accounting. If there's a complete disconnect, you might decide you don't need to do that, but that's up to the local standard setters. Critical to that is the things like the charter that we have with national standard setters, that we maintain good communication and people are well informed. There are also some things that there are other standard setters. They might have some administrative burden type legislation that they have to comment on, or some specific requirements before they endorse standards. The ISB, it's not their responsibility to do all of those things. They rely on those standard setters to do that work themselves. But by maintaining good communication, it's possible that when we do some of our field work, we can do it in collaboration. So it means the standard set, national standard setters are getting the information at the same time that we're collecting the information that we need for our decision making as well. So a lot of this is about communication. We've talked quite a bit in the last session about evidence and so on, so I'm not going to do too much in there, but essentially proportionality and relevance, which came up before, comes up here as well. When you've got a major project, something like leases, we've done a lot of work on that in terms of assessing and analysis of financial reporting data, analysis of financial statements, the outreach. It's a tremendous amount of work that's gone in. I'd expect to do more on a project like that than I would for a narrow scope improvement to change the way depreciation is recognised on revenue-based depreciation. It's not to say it's not important, but I think the level of work is can be quite different. So you have to set this up so it's proportional to the changes you're proposing. The second thing is that the type of work we do will depend on where we are in the phase. Like the research phase, it's more about trying to identify and understand what the problem is. As we develop a proposal, even the straw man, you'd like to think that we've actually gone out and said, look, you know, let's say that we're going to go to, instead of an incurred loss model, an expected loss model, you want to probably go and make sure you've done some work with the banks to see if they've got the data there or what data they would need to implement that. So you don't want to propose a straw man that's going to fail because you haven't done your homework. So some of the work is actually talking to people and understanding what how their systems work, whether they can do that, and clearly the investors and other analysts and users at that stage too, to see whether a straw man that you might develop actually resonates with them. They understand what you're trying to achieve. And then as you get even closer to the finish, I think that some of the work is more more focused on making sure we understand what transitional provisions are required or would work, how long people will actually need to adjust their systems potentially, and even making sure that we've done some work on clarity of the wording, as we did in revenue. We did a lot of work with groups to make sure they could understand the and apply the wording. When we did the consolidation standard, we had these little cases, and we went off to the major firms and to banks and said, if you were to apply these words to these cases, what would the outcome be? To make sure that we've got consistent thinking going on. And that's sort of the latter thing. You can't do that at a discussion paper because you haven't got to a specific proposal. The other thing that's important too is as you develop an exposure draft and you start to lay out what you think the changes are likely to, what the effects are likely to be, you're actually saying this is what we think they're likely to be, and you've got a chance for people to comment on those. So that's why exposure draft phase is perhaps slightly less critical, because you're still gathering information and you're trying to get information from people about whether they agree with your estimates or thoughts about what the likely effects are. Of course, once you finish it, you're done. So what you're doing is you're summarising what you think the impact will be, and you've lost the opportunity to then go and ask for more because you're about to put these things in place. So that's probably the last most critical piece in it. I'm not going to talk about the sources of evidence, but we are aware, you know, the sort of thing when we develop a program is that comment letters are very important to us because people, they sign up to them. They're public documents. They state publicly what their view is, but they're also probably slightly biased. And we know that only 4% on average of our comment letters come from the user community. So we have to supplement that. So we look at all the evidence we've got, and we try to identify a program that actually goes and supplements and complements the comment letter program. We do simulation work, lots of things that we've done. Perhaps the most important thing is the reporting at this stage, because this is the bit that I found. We were sitting with the consultative group, and they were saying, you should be doing this. And we say, yeah, we do. And then they'd suggest all these things and say, well, we actually do that. And if you almost like if you look on our website and 15 clicks later and inside a board paper, that explains it. And what's very clear is that once you've actually finished a project, communicating the process you've been through is very, very important, not just in the basis for conclusions. And there are two aspects here. The first is, if we're going to do field work, we often say things like, well, users told us. And the first thing they say is, well, which ones did you speak to? And because it's not that they don't trust us, but you go and speak to a bunch of analysts, then somebody else goes to, and you hear slightly different things. So they want to know why they've got different messages. So we think it's very important, and the group thinks that once you've got to do some sort of field testing, if, as in the impairment side, we had a case study we took out, people want to see what that case study is. So they see the actual instruments. Ideally, they want to know who participated and what they said and so on. Unfortunately, you can't always do that because people won't participate with us in these projects if you name them. So we have some anonymity in there as well. We're aware of that, but the idea would be that as much as you can indicate the types of people you spoke to, the geographical, demographic spread, and so on, so people can paint a picture and understand how widespread or how representative your sampling was. So that's the ongoing field work. In terms of reporting, I think people don't expect huge amount of effects analysis in the discussion paper. It's built into your analysis of why you're undertaking the problem. At the end, though, is probably the biggest issue, is that the recommendation of the group is that we do have a separate report. And that's part because our basis for conclusions tends to follow the structure of the standard. It follows it paragraph by paragraph, explaining the decisions taken. Now, Henry, how long is revenue recognition? 510 paragraphs. So I think Lisa's was 70,000 words or something like that. So they are long documents. And people are interested in getting a much higher level assessment of the likely effects. Don't want to go through all these technical arguments. They want to get something more summative and more purpose-built. So we think the group thinks it's important that we have a summary at the end that just wraps up the thinking, the motivation for the project, and why those decisions were made. Our assessment is it's not a major hardship for us, because if we do this right, we're actually doing this right through the whole process, and all we're doing is gathering up and summarising the decisions and the actions that the board has taken right through the whole project. And the report content itself, this should be nothing unusual about what I'm saying here. It should set out a clear specification of what you think the board thinks the problem is, why it needs fixing, why it chose to fix it in a particular way, why it will be an improvement, and why it concluded that it's a cost-beneficial solution. Okay, it's not a cost-benefit analysis. It's more about why you've improved financial reporting and why you think that reporting, that improvement is justifiable or justified. So that's a quick run through. The next steps, the ISB is going to be a chance to review the document. Trustees will look at it in July, and then we expect to release the report. We've actually employed a person specifically to develop a toolkit for us. So the staff have actually got a toolkit to be able to make sure they know how to run field testing and field work and so on. So, and then we've got some improvements planned on how to communicate what we're doing on our website. Because lots of stuff is hidden away. We want to try and bring this into purpose-built places on our website so people can see.
Thank you very much, Alan, for that update as to where, if you like, the effects analysis report is at and the key messages in there. Obviously, the next steps, we will see it as advisory council members when it is released, mid-July-ish, immediately after the trustees have seen it.
Yeah, I think that once the trustees have seen it, it's just a matter of formatting and so on and getting the final sign-off from the group.
Yeah, so sign-off. So now is an opportunity, obviously, not to delve into the detail or necessarily question the conclusions that they've reached. However, questions or comments that people do have of Alan now, we do have a little bit of time. Lothar.
Yes, thank you. Just a short comment with regard to the costs on the user side. I think at least the perceived costs are quite significant. It's not something to be pushed aside. With starting with analysts who have to redo their models, which is quite a big effort, and then understand what the changes which are actually reported are and what they mean. Quantitative investors who have to either screening investments or even having a fully quantitative approach, which depends on historical data. We'll have to change their models. Plus, and that's, I think, an important thing you introduce, actually, initially, a higher degree of uncertainty, because you have to, in many cases, rely on historical time series to do your analysis as an analyst or as an investor. So I'm just trying to say that those are all things which will have to be overcompensated by the then positive effects of having more information that's needed. I just wanted to reinforce this a little bit. I was afraid it was too low on the agenda.
Thank you. Steve?
Thank you, Joanna. I generally agree with the effect analysis consultative group's recommendation because the effect analysis is the fundamental job of the board. It is important to conduct objective, thorough, and exhaustive assessment of the analysis. Therefore, my suggestion is that the board to establish the subcommittee for the effect analysis.
So that is in addition, so effectively on an ongoing basis, is your recommendation?
The consultative group is outside the board, right? So the inside the board, I think you need the subcommittee for the effect analysis.
Isabel.
My question is about the ownership of the document that's going to be produced. Is it something that's endorsed by the board, which I personally think it should be, or is it just staff paper?
It's not. The effect analysis itself. One of the critical things is the board needs to sign off on that, which is why the report itself would be produced at the same time as the basis for conclusions, and it would just be part of that package that the board votes
on. Isabel, is your question, though, about this actual report that is being released in July? No. Fumio?
Yeah, thank you. So I'm referring to page 14, the next step. This shows I think you are directly going to implementation after release of the report. So do you have any plan of such as a public comment? So this is just questions. So I don't mean that I forced to do it.
At this stage, I don't think there's any intention to have any public comment. It's just a matter of getting on with this. I don't think there's anything in the report that would be a surprise to anybody. It's just about, if anything, it's giving the staff and the board in particular the tools to make sure that we've got good field testing in place and field work. So, and the thing is, I think when you produce an exposure draft and you're doing this work anyway, that's a good opportunity for people to provide input as well and suggest that we do different work perhaps in terms of our field work.
Thank you.
Anne?
Thank you. Two thoughts. One question was about this cost-benefit analysis, which is critical to this idea of materiality and how do you prioritise. And it's something at CalPERS that we think about a lot, because individual company-level loss and gain makes no difference to a portfolio our size. What really gets us, one way or the other, risk or return, is systemic risk. So I wonder how you capture that, because particularly for the Financial Stability Board and changes which might be individually expensive for companies and appear to have little benefit for investors actually can accumulate. And I think things like disclosure of leverage and financial instruments, derivatives, all of this is really important. So it's the accumulative effect on the system. So that's one thing to think about, how you capture that when you're doing cost-benefit analysis. The other thought was around this rather pitiful number that only 4% of your comment letters come from users. And I wonder how you're counting users. Because if I think you do it by number of comment letters, you're weighing in the balance, you know, and who the letter's from. So I'll give you an example, the International Corporate Governance Network. I know Molyneux's not here. But a fair number of big funds, including ourselves, typically work through that group so we can come to a consensus with other big owners. And then when we have a joint letter, you've probably captured the views of a global group of major asset owners. So that might be how these comment letters weigh in the balance might be worth thinking about. Has it been signed off by, you know, in the ICGen's case, you've got several trillion dollars worth of money behind a comment. And and linked to that, you've got to wrestle with this tricky business that users do not, you know, are not homogenous. You've got the investment chain to think about. So what an ultimate owner and fiduciary like CalPERS or a pension fund might think important, it's very different from what the traders want. And when you go and talk, and I was thinking about that when Ian said he'd been in the US and had got a certain view that what is or isn't of interest at the moment, that who you talk to in the chain actually has a big, we say the shareholders, yes, that's the law, but you have owners, raiders, and traders. What the trading community needs or finds of interest and benefits very different from what the ownership community needs. So I know that's another challenge, but it might be both on the cost benefit and systemic benefits and the 4% figure, that might be worth looking at differently.
Thanks, Anne. Jake?
Anne, I think, has asked one of the questions that I was going to ask, which is there any intention to stratify the users and understand how they're using the information and whether the change that might be proposed is beneficial to all users in the same way? The other question is one of stratification again, and is there any intention to stratify the preparers? Because quite often changes to financial reporting can have a disproportionately high cost of implementation on the less sophisticated preparer.
So Alan, you'll just take that on board. Francoise?
Well, I have two issues, in fact, in form of, I don't know whether it's questions or recommendations at the same time. I think it's essential, as the response has been given to Isabel, that the effect analysis report is signed off by the board. But more important, I think, is the fact that the results of all this field work is taken into account and reflected in the decision-making process of the ISB in a very clear way, so that you don't have in the end a report, but that you can see how the various steps in the analysis have influenced the decision making when those decisions were made. And the other aspect that I couldn't see is how these fieldwork efforts are shared with others, which to me remains a very important aspect for many reasons. I mean, one we've said very early is a question of cost to constituents, that one constituent is being involved in one effort in which ISB and the standard setter and whoever in the middle is involved at the same time. And also it brings a lot of transparency and avoids these situations when one is speaking to one group and comes with different conclusion than the other. So I think that's an aspect that is essential.
Yeah, Ian.
There's been some very good points made on how you handle your responses, and quite genuine points. I think that not all responses are necessarily equal. And I think, as Anne said, you know, it may be accumulation of views. We might get rote letters, 300 rote letters all saying the same thing. Do we count that? So it's not a numbers game. It's very judgmental. And to try and do it scientifically even is really, really difficult, because you have to judge each response. And if you've got 500 or 600 of them, and we try to avoid doing numbers when the staff present the results of an outreach to us, we try not to say 10% thought this, 35% thought that. Well, you try to gauge what the feeling is, but there isn't a perfect answer, and it's very judgmental, and then how you use that advice is also very judgmental. And that's what the board's there for, really.
And presumably, Ian and Alan, I mean, to me, the comments coming through, I mean, the report is the report. It's how you then implement it, and I think the comments that are coming through are around how you actually get the implementation and how scientific you can actually get around some of these things and using the judgment around that. So it is the toolkit. A couple, I think Vincent and... No, Jake's taken his down. Just Vincent, and then we'll break for lunch. Vincent.
I take the point that's being made that a lot of the evidence gathering is already in place, but I guess the call was for there to be more of that. And presupposing that this is going to be a lot more explicit, the effect analysis, I guess my question is around what will be the interaction of this particular process with the post-implementation review? Is that going to change if the texture of the effect analysis changes as well?
Alan?
And I don't think there are no plans to change the post-implementation review. I think the post-implementation review process is a very good example of us in practice collecting evidence to support our summary. So we haven't just looked at the standard and said, you know, well, we think it's working okay. We've actually collected evidence, information, done analysis. We've done literature reviews with academic research. So we've used multiple ways to give the board comfort that it's either working well or identify where issues where it might need to be fixed. I think if we get this right, we'll actually just, we'll find the post-implementation reviews, we find fewer and fewer surprises because we've actually done the investment up front.
Yes, certainly that was my thought, Vincent, when you raised that, was that there will be an impact, probably because it will make the post-implementations more effective or easier, yeah, because you've got the information. Okay, I think that's been, I mean, obviously a number of questions asked of Alan there, but also some thoughts around how to actually put that toolkit or some of the things to put in the toolkit to help you to do that analysis. So thank you for that, both on an update on the research and on the effects analysis, an understanding of that. So we'll break for lunch and